Hey friends, I just want to thank our sponsor, Nexmo. Nexmo is an API platform that allows developers to integrate communications features like voice and SMS into their projects. Nexmo's comprehensive set of tools includes powerful APIs, libraries, and SDKs that allow developers to build and iterate quickly in the language of their choice, whether it's C#, Node, PHP, Java, Python, and more. Visit developer.nexmo.com, that's nexmo.com/Hansel, to learn more about Nexmo. That's developer.nexmo.com/Hansel, H-A-N-S-E-L, to learn more. Hi, this is Scott Hansel, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Julia Evans. She is a infrastructure engineer at Stripe and a famous zine creator. I love your zines, and I'm excited every time I see one go by on my timeline.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So you make zines. They are kind of hard to define. How would you call it? What is a zine from your perspective?
I think a lot of the time people confuse the word like zine and comic, if that makes sense. So what I think of as a zine is it's like usually a handmade 20-page-ish thing that you make and you either like give away or sell to people, right? It's like it's something which is usually independently published. It's not like the production values are not usually that high, right? Like when I make zines, I like print them on my home printer and like give them to people or sell them to people. Sometimes I go to my local print shop and I'll print like 200, but it's like an independent undertaking where you write like a small booklet about something that you love or that you think more people should know about.
This makes me feel like I was in like in the 80s when I was in school. I would print out like I couldn't afford like trading cards or like, yeah, you know, garbage pail kids or whatever. So we just make our own, like, and cut them out with scissors and give them to our friends. And they're all black and white. And if you could find someone's copy machine where you didn't have to pay 5 cents a page, like, all the better.
Yeah, I think that's the aesthetic. Yeah. And then, so, like, I make zines, which are collections of comics. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people refer to those comics as zines. But a zine is, like, it has multiple pages. Mm-hmm. And it's, a thing.
And some of them have a lot of text. Like there's like some of your Linux comics, you have like a really cool 24-page zine of comics Linux. And sometimes there'll be like a whole page with like one stick figure. But then you'll do other ones, like you have a whole zine on TCP dump, which is like a totally different art style. And it's very, very sophisticated. Your art style seems to scale with the topic.
Is that true? I think that those two are the same. Like their covers... The cover of the TCP dump zine is different, but...
Oh, okay. So the cover has a different style than the insides.
Yeah, because I hire illustrators to do the covers, but I do everything insides myself, and I only know how to draw stick figures.
Okay. I was always wondering that, because when I saw kind of your most famous one, and you want to be you want to be a wizard, like I'm like, wow, she can draw stick figures and this like totally comic front end. So that's cool. So the cover art is by another person.
Yeah, I can only draw stick figures. Actually.
But you're still a successful zine artist doing only stick figures. Do you do them on the computer or is it like an iPad pencil or something?
I do them on an iPad with the Apple Pencil, yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at one, for example, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, like let's say, how does DNS work, right? It's like four frames of a comic and it's got a minimal amount of text and some stick figures. If I copied it as a PowerPoint, I have a feeling it would not go viral and no one would care. And it probably wouldn't teach anyone, but it's so fun in the style. Like, why does a zine work when a PowerPoint doesn't?
So one thing that I actually think is really important about zines is kind of like the physical nature of them. Like, I definitely like have them on the internet and like, I love people read them on the internet and you can read it on your screen, of course. But the reason I started writing zines is that I was going to a conference. I was going to PyCon, actually, and I was giving a talk at PyCon, which was a big deal, and I was very excited. And I decided to bring a zine along and hand it out to everyone in the audience, right? So I went to the print shop and, like, paid $200 and, like, printed a few hundred zines. And then I gave them out to everyone. And, like, people have told me, they're like, oh, I still have that zine, and I still, like, look at it, like, 4 years later, right? And, of course, that's never going to happen with a PowerPoint, right? Or they'll say like, oh, I saw your zine, like someone gave it to me, or I saw it in someone's office and I picked it up and then I learned something. And I think that like the fact that it's like an artifact in the world, which you can like pass around and give to your friends, makes it something that I think is a lot easier to learn from.
Interesting. It's interesting because you want it to seem small and personal, but if it scales, like if you became super famous zine person, how would you make them all small and personal for a million people?
Well, I don't know. Well, this is a good question, but I feel like I've read a lot of books which did feel like small and personal to me.
Hmm.
If that makes sense. Like, because like sometimes when you read a book, it feels like the person is just speaking to you, right? And you're like, oh, this book was written for me. How did you know? And I think that's kind of the feeling I want to impart. It's like, hello, I wrote this for you.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And I think that's like the amazing thing about print, right? And about writing.
Mm-hmm. Do you even like this started out and you printed out for 200 people, but do you do like 1,000 print runs now? And like it's become a big thing.
Yeah. So I spoke at Deconstruct recently, which is this conference in Seattle, and we printed 2,000 zines.
Oh, wow.
Which was really fun. Yeah. We printed copies, like maybe 300 copies of all of my zines.
Do you consciously try to make them like, and forgive the way I'm phrasing this, like not polished? Like, for example, if a zine is like you photocopied and it's slightly askew, it just means it has personality, right? But if you did like an actual print run for like a New York Times bestselling something and it was askew, people would like lose their minds.
Yeah. Is it intentional? Well, I mean, it's kind of a matter of like, I'm not an extremely good designer or artist, right? Like, so I think that there's kind of like an upper limit to like the amount of polish I'm practically speaking going to produce, especially because I do it in my spare time, right? Like, I do it after work. So I think it's just not going to happen. Like maybe at some point I'll make things that are more polished. But I think people really like it too. Like, I think having something handwritten is a huge deal in like the fact that like I think part of it is like people are like, oh, you took the time to write all this information down by hand. It must be important.
Oh, that's interesting. You think that people are like ascribing depth to something that's consciously not deep because it was handwritten?
I think so. Like, well, because I think if you write something by hand, it does make it more important, right? Because it takes me like 5 times longer to write something by hand than it would to type it.
How many times do you have to do these before you know that you got it right? Because it's not just like you didn't just scribble. You like there is structure and thought because there is a learning style where you ask a question, you present a problem, and then you make a helpful you walk someone through it. Like there's a linearization to this that is important.
Yeah. So one hard thing is like, so let's say like you're writing a comic about some important concept, like, I don't know, virtual memory, right? And like in these, like, especially in these 6-panel comics I do, I'll often only write something like 50 words in them, right? So you have this huge topic and you need to describe it in 50 words. And how do you do that? And so what I do a lot of the time is I'll like sit on my couch with this like pained look on my face and I'll be like, what can I say? Like, what are 5 words that I can say that are true about this topic?
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard, right? Because like making statements that are like at least like 90% true,
mm-hmm.
That are short and that are understandable is so hard. But it's possible, right? And then once I do it, people are like, oh, wow, I understand this now. And so maybe like sometimes it'll take me an hour to write like a 10-word sentence. But like usually I can come up with something faster than that, but not always. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I'm looking, for example, like the memory allocation one. Like we've all read like entire books on memory allocation. But you're getting it down to the essence, and it's clear that you didn't just like bang that out in 5 minutes.
Yeah, was, like what does that one say even?
Well, it says at any given time your program has a fixed amount of memory, and then it shows like kind of a defragmentation kind of a thing where it shows pieces of memory, some of which is used and some of which is free, and then it says and you can ask the OS for more memory, and then you've got like this happy figure that represents Google Chrome taking 2 gigabytes of your RAM, which I thought was funny. And then it has like a person who's allocating. And it's like, oh, can I allocate some? And then you basically show pieces of memory being malloced. And then you talk about different alternatives to malloc with Facebook or Google having different mallocs.
Right. And like this thing where you can ask your operating system for more memory is like, it's like not a trivial piece of information, right?
Mm-mm.
Like it's not obvious that like this interaction where you're like, hey, operating system, can I have more memory, is something that your program is doing. Mm-hmm. But then when you explain it like that, it seems simple.
And I think it's cool that you always have the little people having a conversation with the computer, which somehow makes the computer more approachable. What I think is interesting is that since you are a infrastructure engineer and you're a back-end engineer and you're a low-level Linux engineer, you're talking about like syscalls, which for a lot of people is a scary thing.
Right.
And then we have these happy little people making syscalls. And I'm like, oh, well, is that all a syscall is? That's not as scary as I thought it was.
Right. Because this thing like where you ask for more memory, you're either using like the BRK, like BRK syscall, or you're using the MMAP syscall. And it's not like, I mean, I guess if you could write it in a way that sounds really unapproachable, but really like computers are just communicating all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think comics are a really good way to show that because you're always doing networking, right? Like your program is talking to your operating system, your programs are talking to each other. And so what I like to do is kind of like break down what the interfaces are, right? Like the system call interface, and then just like show that with a comic. And you're like, okay, here's piece one and here's piece two. And then here's like the interface where they talk to each other. And then here's what they're saying. Because that's just what happens on computers, right? Like, mm-hmm. And that's how I think about it, is you just have these different components interacting. And I think trying to explain it with comics makes it seem a lot, just like makes it a lot more straightforward.
Yeah. I like also that some of the comics are kind of unapologetic about stuff. So for example, you've got one on the OSI model for networking. I'm like, oh, she's going to explain like all the layers, right? Layer 7, da 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 da. And they're like, oh, well, layer 5 and 6, no one ever talks about these. Like you just like, bleh. We're not going to talk about those two layers because they suck.
Yeah.
I thought that was awesome.
They do suck.
Layers 5 and 6 are trash. We will not speak of them again.
Yeah. 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 Well, one thing that I kind of think is important is I try not to use metaphors because I don't understand metaphors. Like I try to make things simple, but I don't try to be like, oh, this is like this other thing, because often it's like not. Hmm. When people use metaphors, I'm like, I don't understand what you mean. Like,
that's really interesting because like I think of myself as a teacher and all I have is metaphors. So that's very interesting. So here we are, two people presenting information in two different ways, and sometimes it's effective and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, obviously other people use metaphors effectively, but I don't understand how to use them at all. So I just try to simplify things and then come up with like the simplest version of the truth that I can come up with. And then I just say that.
Mm-hmm. This is a tough question, but have you ever had a zine that was just a huge fail? Like you put it out there and nobody got it and no one understood. And then you just like made that zine disappear and redid it.
Have I? I don't think so. Well, I don't know. I mean, I've written like 7 zines, right?
But you've written hundreds and hundreds of comics.
I've written a lot of comics. I mean, some of the comics are, of course, bad.
Well, yeah, let me back it up. So I actually did what you warned me to. I misused. Zines are collections of comics. Have you done an individual comic that just didn't land the way you wanted it to land?
I can't remember a specific one that I thought. Okay, here's like, this is more of a blog post, maybe. Mm. There are all these Linux tracing systems, which let you basically trace what your operating system is doing. Mm-hmm. So like there's like ftrace and... They're all a little bit obscure, I guess. Mm-hmm. And like most people don't know about them. And I was really upset that I couldn't like find like a summary of like what all the Linux tracing systems were. So mm-hmm. I wrote this really long blog post kind of summarizing like at a high level like what all these systems do. Mm-hmm. And I think that everyone would be really excited about it. And what I forgot is that like I don't think most people really care about Linux tracing systems. Like I think it's mostly just me.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, people do like, I mean, my partner just told me the other day, he was like, oh, I saw someone like link your blog post on this mailing list saying that it was really useful. And I was like, oh, cool. Like somebody did care. But like, I think like I forgot how niche of a topic it was in a way, which is fine. Like I like to write about things that are niche topics because I think that those things often end up being really underserved. Mm. And I would in a way rather write about that than write about something like JSON. Because I'm like, well, people understand JSON. Like, I don't need to explain JSON. There's a lot of material out there. I'd rather write about Linux tracing systems and explain what's going on with like ftrace.
It is kind of frustrating though. Like I've been blogging for a long time, and I'll feel like I'll spend a week on a blog with like sample code and charts and graphs and tables and like timings, and I get no comments and no one cares, and you get like 10 likes. But then you write a blog post about like carriage return line feed in Git. Yeah. The internet loses their mind.
Yeah. I try to sort of time box how much time I spend on it on any given thing. Mm-hmm. Like, this is part of why I like to post like individual zine pages on Twitter as I go to sort of like see what the reaction is. And just like get a sense of what people think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people find mistakes also, which is great. It's very helpful. But yeah, like for any individual comic, I think I try not to spend more than like a couple of hours on it.
That's cool. And you're publishing these though now, like you started making these and you would just like put them out. You'd hand them to people, like a couple hundred here. You'd print them all yourself. But I can go up now and I can buy these, like get the print version. If I like do the get the print version, do you want me to print this out or should I buy it from, can I buy it from Amazon or are you selling them?
You can't buy a printed version right now. That's a project that I need to discover an extra few dozens of hours to
yeah.
get to happen. I haven't figured out how to do it yet. But yeah, so right now if you buy it, you can print it out.
Mm-hmm. Does it feel like there's a business here, though? Like, I could go and get, like, t-shirts of zines and comics?
I don't know. So, I feel like apparel is exciting. People love apparel. But I'm really excited about selling, like, printed stuff mm-hmm. and, like, educational material. Because I feel like there's a huge need for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I guess, so I've been writing for free for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been great, and I love doing it. But I've kind of realized, I think, that there's sort of, like, an upper bound, like, how much you can do for free, actually.
Really?
Because, like, if you want to make something really good, you need to spend time on it.
Yeah.
And there's, like, only so much time, I think, that it's possible to spend doing things for free, if that makes sense. Like I've been thinking about, like so, sometimes I go to conferences and I feel like frustrated with the talks. But what I realized is like people don't get paid to give talks, right?
Yeah. Well, some people, I guess. I guess there's like there are paid like famous people that get money, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. But like the incentives are sort of misaligned, right? Like people aren't being paid to give educational talks.
Yeah.
And like I mean, to the extent that people at tech conferences do get paid to give talks, they're getting paid to like market things to you.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Because the famous people all have a book to sell or whatever.
Yeah. And so I've been thinking about sort of like how can you structure like a business so that the incentives are correctly aligned so that you can actually like focus on education. Which I feel like isn't really true in the publishing industry right now. Because if you publish a book with like a mainstream tech publisher, you're not going to make that much money. And so like it's like your financial incentives are not actually set up to really focus on education.
Right, right. Well, and they're going to go and sell dead trees, and they'll sell the dead tree for like $40 to a teacher who can't afford it, and you'll get a dollar or two. And then their next year, they're going to want you to update all of your stuff with the latest version, and they can sell more dead trees.
Yeah, and part of the reason I think zines are exciting is that they're pretty fast to produce. And because like technology is always moving, you can write something like fairly quickly about something maybe even relatively recent, which is, I mean, I don't do this, right? I write about things like asterisks, which are like 10 years old, or about like GC beat up. I actually write about extremely relatively old stuff most of the time that hasn't changed and probably isn't going to change.
Mm-hmm.
But you can, right? And I think it's a lot easier to write something short. And then people will actually read short things, unlike books, which I think they mostly won't read.
No, that's a good point, though, because like I have memorized like every single line to Hamilton and the audiobook, and I follow the guy on Twitter, da, 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 and I've been sitting on the actual book of Hamilton, like the one that he based the musical on. It's like 600 pages. It's been moving around my house, but it's never actually been read, which is stressing me out. I feel like Twitter has ruined my ability to read long form stuff, but I'll read your zines. They're, you know, because they're not 600 pages.
Yeah. And I think even some of my favorite tech books, I've only read like two chapters of them.
Yeah. Code Complete. Steve McConnell's Code Complete.
Right. And some of those chapters are really good. Like they're not bad books.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've been thinking about like, well, like what if we focused on smaller things and like really focused on being like, what if we just make 20 pages but make those 20 pages so good and make them like really what you need to know.
Yeah. Like some of your, like I could read an entire chapter on like how the Linux proc directory works, but I read your zine and I feel like I pretty much get it. And there's probably 100 words on the entire thing.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then you can always go to the man page, right? Like if you want to know more.
Exactly. Hey folks, Intel is a sponsor this week and I welcome them because they're bringing some high performance developer tools for all of us. Check out Intel's Parallel Studio XE. I've talked about parallelism before on the show and the importance of using the complete instruction set. unlocking the power of the processor that your code is running on. Now, you all might be writing C or C++, Python, or even Fortran, but is your code building in such a way and written in such a way that it uses the latest techniques for vectorization, multi-threading, multi-node parallelization, or memory optimization? Intel Parallel Studio XE has a lot of new stuff for 2018 across all these languages. Get a free download at bit.ly.com/ParallelStudioXE, or certainly go and Google or Google with Bing for Intel Parallel Studio XE, and get started boosting your app's performance with smart parallel code with a lot less effort. Check them out, bit.ly.com/ParallelStudioXE. So, you're somewhat senior. Would you call yourself an intermediate developer? How long have you been in developing?
How long? So I learned programming 15 years ago.
Okay. So do you feel like there's a special place for like that 10, 15 year intermediate developer learning where we want to learn more a certain way?
I think so. Like, I feel like there's so much material for beginners right now. Like, yeah. If you want to learn a programming language, there's like these like Learn Python the Hard Way, right? Which I've heard really good things about. Mm-hmm. And there's so little material, I think, for intermediate to like maybe advanced developers. Mm-hmm. I think I had this really sort of formative experience 5 years ago.
Okay.
Where someone told me about strace, which is this tool that traces system calls on Linux. And I didn't know, I didn't know that system calls existed. Like, I didn't know how programs talk to the operating system at all. And I didn't know that you could trace them with strace. I think at that point, I'd been programming for 10 years. And I felt kind of, like, angry almost. Like, I was like, why didn't anyone tell me before? Right? And, like, where was I supposed to learn this? And I realized that for a lot of things, there's sort of no way. Like, I mean, of course, like, someone could have told me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's possible that I guess I could have met someone who told me, but I didn't, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, wait, how am I supposed to learn these things? Right? Like, how are we supposed to learn new things that are pretty fundamental, right? Like, the fact that, like, system calls are how your program talks to your operating system is, like, a pretty fundamental fact about how computers work. Mm-hmm. And, of course, like, you can say, like, oh, well, Julia, you should have taken the operating systems class in university instead of not taking it, right? But, like, university classes are not, I don't think, are, like, the solution to, like, ongoing developer education, right? Like, once you graduate from university, you will have learned some things. But, like, no matter what university you went to, you're still going to have not learned some, like, important and fundamental things anyway. And so it's like, well, how does it happen that you learn those things, right?
Well, like, I was talking to my spouse a couple of days ago, and it turns out that she doesn't know how to change her oil. Now, mm-hmm. Here's a person who's been driving for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So she's a senior driving engineer.
Yeah.
Who am I to say, how do you not know how to change your oil? But that seems to be the way the community approaches stuff like that. Like, how do you not know that? She also doesn't know how to drive a stick shift.
Right.
I could like lose my mind and like, I don't know, stick shift shame her for not knowing how to drive a stick. But at the same time, shouldn't I be happy that automatic shift cars work and they work great, so much so that she doesn't need to know that? So then the question is, as an intermediate developer, what am I supposed to know and what's a waste? Like, do I need to know how to change my own oil or do I just hire someone to do that?
Yeah, right. So it's like, how do you figure out what you do need to know? And like, once you decide you want to know those things, like, what are the resources you're going to use to learn that?
Yeah, yeah. There's no, like, you wouldn't go and find Python for intermediate people. There's not like, that book doesn't exist.
Yeah. And I think like I was reading the C++ programming book a little bit because I wanted to learn a little bit of C++. And it was like, oh, here's what a variable is. And I was like, I can't, what? Like, what is this book? Like, I'm not reading this, right? Like, I'm not reading someone like explain to me what a function is for 10 pages. Like, I want to learn like what I need to know about C++ as someone who knows like these like 8 other programming languages already. But I don't know C++, right? Like, there are lists of like tricky things about C++ that are really surprising. Someone coming from another language. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I was like, this is really hard.
It always feels weird. Like I learned that I was mispronouncing a word for the last 40 years of my life, like yesterday. Now, and my wife is not, you know, she's like, how did you make it this far? So if that's happening to me as a native English speaker, like imagine how much computer science or software engineering that I've gotten wrong, that I'm like walking around thinking I know X and it's actually Y. It's going to blow my mind. And there's not only like, where do I go to learn it and where do I learn to fix that? But also like as a community, we should be able to be public and be comfortable to say, oh, I'd never learned how to do that. Right. But if you told someone you didn't know how to do a bubble sort, you probably lose your job.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, I feel we should be more kind of supportive of people in their learning. And I always appreciate you on Twitter because I know you know what you're talking about. It's clear in your writing. You have a great blog and mediums and all of your zines are fantastic. But at the same time, I feel like you're very enthusiastic about learning stuff. And I wonder if people are ever like, oh, you should have known that, Juliet. Ugh, how did you get this far? I hate it when people do that kind of stuff because I'm always learning new hotkeys and new syscalls.
Yeah, like I guess so. I think I've spent a lot of time getting better at learning. I think it's really exciting to come up with like questions of things that I don't know.
Mm.
Like to me, it's exciting to learn new things, right? Like it's not exciting to say that like, oh, I know everything already because like that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's pretty boring. Like if I knew everything in programming, I would probably quit. Like I don't know. Like it sounds awful. I would much rather be learning new things.
Mm.
And so, like, I think the idea that it's, like, even desirable to know everything is something that I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I mean, sometimes, like, maybe someone on Hacker News will be like, oh, like, I can't believe you didn't know, like, such and such.
Is that that's your Hacker News accent?
But it's just kind of silly, right? Like, I mean, and, like, a lot of people don't know a lot of things. And like it's like an exciting opportunity to learn that thing, right? You're like, oh, great! Today is the day that today is the day that I get to learn that thing, and that's fine.
Exactly, and that's the way we all should be. You know, we should be positive about that stuff, and because not everyone has like we may all have 10 or 15 years experience, but not everyone has the same years.
Yeah,
we're doing different stuff. What were you doing before you were an infrastructure engineer?
I was doing machine learning. Oh, I switched from machine learning to doing infrastructure engineering 2 years ago.
Oh, wow. But like machine learning is like the new hotness that everyone's talking about. So you're doing it before it was the hotness.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was also the hotness 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I don't have a sense in my mind of like when machine learning started being amazing.
I think machine learning has been cool for a minute.
My bad. So you also do a lot of open source and you actually took a sabbatical from work to write a profiler. How did you do that?
I actually sort of don't do a lot of open source. I took a sabbatical from work to do open source for 3 months. But the reason I did that was that I don't do open source in my spare time at all.
Really? That's healthy.
Yeah. Well, I do a lot of other like writing in my spare time. So if I also programmed in my spare time, in addition, I think it would not be healthy.
Yeah.
I think it'd be too much. But yeah, so I had this profiler I wanted to write and I was like, well, I want to do this programming project. And realistically speaking, I'm not going to do it in my spare time. So I applied for a fellowship and they gave me the fellowship and then I took 3 months off work and wrote this profiler.
Wow. Was that stressful?
No, it was great.
That's amazing. That must be the thing that only Canadians could do because I don't know if I could get healthcare if I took 3 months off work.
Oh yeah, that's true. I don't know about that. I think someone asked me, they're like, oh, do you get healthcare on your sabbatical? And I was like, I have no idea. I didn't think about that at all.
Yeah. That's like another whole podcast right there. If it's like, oh my goodness, a 3 month sabbatical to work on like something I want to work on. That would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I just asked my manager for permission like 6 months in advance.
Oh, really? Okay. So you like paused your job.
Yeah.
And came back to the same job.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. So you made RB Spy, and people can go and Google for RB Spy or go to rbspy.github.io. Have other people gotten involved with this profiler? Because it's got lots of forks and stars, but are people using it and digging it?
People are using it. Yeah, they've told one person left this really delightful comment that made me happy, where they said that they'd had this like really bad performance problem in their Ruby program, mm-hmm. and then they used RB Spy, and then they found out what was wrong right away, and they fixed it, and their boss thought that they were a genius.
Which is exactly like become a wizard programmer. Like they've done exactly what you told them they could do.
Yeah, which is what you want, right? I feel like it's exciting to build tools which help people like be better, and like make them feel like. I don't know. Like I want people to feel like they can do anything, right?
And was it a problem that had existed before? Like, is there just no good profiling for Ruby right now?
There is a good profiler, but it doesn't work the same way that RBSpy works. So the way RBSpy works is you can just like attach it to any running Ruby program, no matter what.
Mm.
And the other profilers that already existed, you need to kind of like edit your program source code.
Oh.
And so being able to just like poke at something that's already running and be like, hey, what are you doing? Is something that wasn't possible before.
That's cool. And I understand that it's a sampling profiler, so you can actually run it like in production without fear.
Yeah, that's right.
That's pretty sweet. And are you continuing work on it, or have you developed a community and a team around it, or is it just you?
It's mostly just me. I'm still working on it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that you were trying to do some flame graphs as well. Like it produces like information that you can then use to go and visualize.
Yeah, yeah. So it produces visualizations by default, which was a really important design decision I made, actually, because I think like a lot of profilers will require you to do like extra work to get a visualization. And I thought, well, that doesn't really work for people, because I think people who are profiling usually, like, if they're doing profiling, they probably haven't done it for like 2 years, right? Like they've just decided, okay, today is the day that I'm going to do profiling and I don't know how to do this. What's going on? Mm-hmm. So you really like want to give them, like you want to make the experience as easy for them as possible, because profiling is something that people do so infrequently.
Right.
So I thought it was really important to create the visualization by default. And people have said, they're like, oh, wow, I didn't know that you could make this kind of visualization. And so I think they wouldn't have thought to go do it themselves because they didn't know that it existed, right?
Yeah. Like, and if you have to go and do a bunch of setup just because you want to ask, like, answer and ask a question, then we won't bother doing it. So the flame graph comes out of the box.
Yeah.
That's cool. Awesome. And that you did that in just in 3 months. Had you been working on it before, or did you do it all like beginning to end in 3 months?
I built a prototype before.
Awesome.
So I kind of had an idea that it was possible, which is what kind of gave me the confidence to actually take 3 months off work to work on it, right?
And when you did the grant, like, do you have to then go to the grant people and say, look, I did a thing?
Yeah. I mean, I said, like, I think I'd been blogging about it. So they obviously knew that I'd been working on it. And so I think, like, at the end, I just sent them an email and I was like, hey, I did the thing. Can you send me the money? It was pretty simple. They were really great to work with.
That's awesome. That's really cool. I didn't even realize that one could like ask for a grant and get it and do something like that. And that's inspirational to know that you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. The program was called the Segment Open Source Fellowship. There's this analytics company called Segment that ran it.
Very cool. So people can check out your zines. Should they just go to jvns.ca, or is there a better homepage for your zines?
Yeah, they can go there.
Cool. So you can just Google for Julia Evans zines. You're everywhere, and follow you on Twitter. And you're kind of working on comics all the time. And I follow you on Twitter and see those things go by. And RB Spy, of course, is rbspy.github.io. Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.